Hello and welcome to Racist Sandwich, the podcast about food, race, class, and gender. I'm your co-host, Zahir John Muhammad.
And I'm Alan Montecilio, filling in for Salejo.
Today we have a very special and a little bit of a different episode for you from our usual. We're interviewing Amy Lamb, who is an associate editor at Bitch Media. And Amy is actually about to head out from Portland. She's lived here for, I think, 10 years or something like that. And she's moving to Oxford, Mississippi to start her MFA in fiction as a fellow there. So this episode today examines food and race and writing.
It's a little bit different, as you mentioned, Zahir, from what we usually do. You know, so far we've been interviewing people who work explicitly with food. But I think with this conversation, I think you start off by talking about food. And she starts off by talking about her relationship with food and then connecting it to writing.
Amy started a group in Portland, or should say co-founded, called the Portland Creatives of Color, which was started last fall. And it's because of that group that Soleil and I met, my co-host, and also Alan and I met as well, too. And I think there's something like 400 people of color on that group. And it's been a really incredible place to meet people, to share work. So it's been a really wonderful place.
Yeah, Amy's been really instrumental in building community for people of color in Portland and to make people feel like they're seen and heard and that they could belong in the city too. I think the thing about that group too that I think a lot of people might not recognize is that it's not just, as you mentioned, it's been a space for creative collaboration, but it's also a place where people sometimes just post like, hey, I was on the bus and this racist thing happened to me. Yeah. I feel alone in the city. I think especially for new arrivals, it's been a place for people to be seen. And so I think it's really hard to overstate how big of a role Amy has played to just make life in this city better for people of color. So
absolutely.
We really enjoyed having her on.
Thank you so much and enjoy the episode.
So, my parents are ethnically Chinese, but they're refugees from the Vietnam War and they immigrated here as refugees in 1978. And that's like the gist of their story. As far as I know, because I feel like oftentimes, especially with refugee immigrants, it's really hard for them to share
their stories.
We don't
talk about it.
Yeah, it's too much trauma. It's too traumatic. I mean, the most that I know is that they're from South Vietnam. And the way I know that is because about 10 years ago, we actually went back for the first time. My parents did. And with myself and my brothers. And so I know that they're from South Vietnam because we went into South Vietnam. But like before that, I really didn't have a geographic location of where they're from. I couldn't even picture where they lived, except for like very bare descriptions of like my dad having to, hide in holes and things when he heard like bombs dropping. I think that for children of refugees in particular, we get like origin stories of our parents, like by piecemeal. It just kind of like trickles out little by little. And so I actually don't know that much about where my parents came from or that much about who they were before they arrived here.
So if you were to ask them a question, like, how would they respond? Like if you said, tell us a little bit about your childhood or how you left, how you were forced out, like would they answer the question or they just kind of evade it?
It's like partially evasion and partial very like short one word, like monosyllabic answers, kind of like, we lived in a small house or, we got on this boat. It wasn't like a dramatic retelling of a story. One of the shows I really love on public television is Antiques Roadshow. Antiques Roadshow came through Oregon a few years ago. And actually, like, I entered the lottery online to get tickets and I got tickets to go. And I was like so excited. My partner and I went and then I was like, well, what am I going to bring? Because I don't have like heirlooms or anything like that I can bring to be like, this is from my family from this generation to explain where we're from. I ended up bringing like a vintage purse that I really loved or something. But it's like, it's one of those things where, you arrive here in America and you might try to give your children like something of who you are, but like, there was nothing tangible that they can give me. So I watch a show like Antiques Roadshow, like pining for these histories and these stories behind objects, but I wasn't given that. So it's like one of those things where not only was I not giving a tangible thing, I wasn't even given like a story about where we're from.
Yeah, like, actually, like the main thing that we've taken, the main knowledge that I have from my grandparents and my family are recipes. That's kind of how I relate to them, because I also don't speak Vietnamese And so the main way I relate to them is like, oh, my grandmother will make something and she'll be like, is that good? And I said, yeah. And that's our conversation, like every time I visit. So, yeah, I mean, do you find that like to be similar, like that sort of relationship between cooking and like understanding your family?
It's hard because I think that for my family in particular, because we're ethnically Chinese and yet they came from Vietnam, it's like, I think that for my parents in particular, they have this weird like colonial or imperial pride about being Chinese. Mm-hmm. Yet like, mm-hmm. they've like the first time they've ever been to China was when we took a trip like in like 8 years ago or something, right? Mm-hmm. And so how Chinese can you be if you've never been to China? That's like a thing that I always struggle with. And you know, we were raised Chinese in quotation marks, you know, like, but it wasn't until I lived in China before they even ever visited that I realized like, wow, like we're not that Chinese, you know? And then I remember a few years before that, I had read a memoir by the writer's name is Alex Pham. I believe the title is called Mandala and Catfish or Catfish and Mandala. And it's about him taking a bike tour through Vietnam. And it wasn't until I read that book, I was like in my mid-20s, that I realized that catfish soup is a Vietnamese dish. Because growing up, that's like the dish my mom cooked. Like you said, having conversations with like your elders, that's the dish my mom cooked to tell me that she cared about me. Mm-hmm. You know, whenever I would visit home after I left home for school and everything, she always, without fault, always made me catfish soup. And that's the way she told me she loved me. And it wasn't until I read this book that I realized, oh, this food that my mom uses to tell me that she loves me is a Vietnamese dish. It's not even a Chinese dish. So, like, how does that inform me about who we are then? Because we're communicating through this dish that, like, she grew up cooking. But yet they were trying to, you know, give me this vague pride about being Chinese, you know? And it got to the point where, you know, in my mid-20s, I like, just very plainly asked my father. I was like, so dad, you know, you're born in Vietnam, mom's born in Vietnam, you know, both your parents are born in Vietnam, like mom's mom was born in Vietnam. So aren't we Vietnamese? And he got really angry at me. He was like legit upset with me because he was like, no, we're Chinese. Like how, kind of like a, how dare you ask us that? I think that also speaks to like internalized racism in Vietnam. Like the Chinese think they're better than the Vietnamese, but it also speaks to, I think, this confusion about like who we are. So like in our family, you know, we eat a mix of Chinese and Vietnamese food. I didn't know that. I thought it was all Chinese food. And there's also this like gender thing about cooking and food that like really like fucked me up as a kid, because I'm the oldest of three and I have two younger brothers. And my dad, really wanted and needed me to like be in the kitchen with my mom, cooking with her. And she's the type of woman who, after most of us like finished elementary school, she wanted to work outside of the home. You know, she was working really hard inside the home, but then she was like, well, you guys are all done, you know, like you don't need me to babysit you to an extent. And so she got job working in like Chinese fast food restaurants, being a server. And she was like, she's the one that would scoop your food into like the styrofoam container.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. So she did that for so long, to the point now she like manages like 3 to 4 or 5, I don't know, like Hawaiian barbecue joints now. You know, this woman
in Los Angeles, really,
in Southern California, like she can't even, she can barely type an email, but she's in charge of like 4 to 5 like fast food Hawaiian barbecue joints. So, you know, she worked her way up, but it's like she still cooks for my dad in the morning. She makes sure he has a lunch to take to work, and then she comes home and she makes and she also in the morning she makes sure to cook dinner so that when he comes home from work he has dinner. You know, she's doing like 3 shifts up to now, even, you know, my, like, she's nearing retirement age, but like this is how hard she's working. So I think it's been deeply ingrained into like her work ethic that like her life is centered around food and cooking. And I think that my father in particular, because my mom didn't really pressure me to do this, but my father did, where he was just like, how come you can't cook? You need to cook like your mom. Even though they were impressing upon me that like I needed to go to school and get a good education and get a good job, but yet also like fulfill this gender role of being their good daughter, and then in the future being somebody's good wife. I have a very vivid memory of like one day I'm trying to do homework, you know, like, and they would like badger me to do my homework. But my dad was so upset with me that he like made me go into the kitchen and watch my mom cook. like just stand. I was like so upset. I'm like almost getting emotional talking about it now, but just like having to stand there and watch my mom like work the walk, you know, and this expectation that like I was supposed to juggle both things. Like he literally pulled me from doing homework to watch my mom like cook stir fried string beans or something, you know, and it was like nothing. This was not the same expectation my younger brothers had to face. So it was this weird balance of like, what do you want from me as your firstborn and as your daughter? I think my dad, like you're saying, Soleil, like there's this like a weird balance of how do we like find who we are here in our new country, but then also like have our children maintain these traditions.
Right. It's almost like he was expecting you to become like the superwoman, like yeah. Your mom. Your mom's obviously like, holy cow, I could not do that.
Yeah. She legitimately has three shifts, and she's also the one who's like cleaning the house. My dad doesn't clean the house, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that for me, like one of the weirdest things for me was how to like navigate, like, wait, you want me to do well in school and have a good job, but you also want me to like spend time cooking? Because I could see that my mom spent a lot of time cooking. Like it wasn't a thing that like she just like, you know, whipped up. It was like an all day affair. Like she had to prep the meat, marinate it, and she like tried to teach this to me, you know, like you use this Lee Kum Kee sauce for this kind of meat, and you slice this meat this way, and then you put in this bowl, and then you put the Saran wrap over it, and you put it in the fridge in the morning, and then by the time it's the afternoon, it's ready to be cooked. And then when you know you put the rice in the rice cooking bowl, you put the water, you put your hand in, and you measure the water by like how far up it goes on your hand, you know, like all these things that she taught me, but my brothers were not expected to know this. So I knew that it was a very laborious thing, and that it wasn't an easy thing. But then they also knew that like school was really hard. It was so hard that like, you know, I think that for a lot of immigrant children, like there comes a point where your parents can't help you with your homework anymore. Like my parents stopped helping me with my homework when I was like in second or third grade. So it was like hard enough where they couldn't help me, but yet there's also this expectation that like I was able to juggle both. Mm-hmm. So it got to the point where like I really disliked cooking. And I think it has a lot to do with this, like, this my history where, like, my father was trying to impose this on me, to have me, like, fulfill this like, very narrow gender role about who was I supposed to be. And it has a lot to do with, like, being a good daughter and then, like, turning into being somebody's really good wife and that you should know how to cook really well.
Yeah. Do you know the phrase stereotype threat?
No.
So it's a sociological phrase. They did this study where like students who they had a mixed group of students, and before they did this test, that the proctor would like express sentiments that like students of this group are probably going to be bad at this test, right? And in the other study, the proctor didn't say anything. And so in the first group, the students of that like of who were stereotyped did worse and felt okay about doing worse, whereas in the other group, like all the students did as well as they normally did. And it's sort of this concept to express how, like, when we feel stereotyped, like, we either, like, there's just, like, it's anxiety about conforming to the stereotype, and it causes us to become disinterested in that thing. So I totally feel you on that, like, on expressing your disinterest, saying that cooking is boring, and how that kind of stems from not wanting to conform to what your family or what your father expected of you, right? Because to do so, to actually embrace cooking, would be to prove him right. I get that.
So how do you like navigate it? Because you're a chef now. You like you professionalized it.
Right, but there's the stereotype of a chef is a man. You know, your mom doesn't get paid for doing the cooking she does at home. And the funny thing for me is like my stereotype threat thing is like mathematics and physics and science. I was really good at it for a while, and then I just stopped. I went to like an Asian science high school, and that was the thing that we were all supposed to be good at, and I just like reverted into writing because I just couldn't handle that. Actually, my mom, she would cook a lot for us also, you know, and she never made the same meal twice, which is really interesting to me, and that's really cool. And she was still like really intellectually interested in cooking. She had all these cookbooks by like Tom Colicchio and like Thomas Keller and like all these like big name chefs. in the house. And so I became interested because she had those books and because she was interested in it out of her own volition. And I think that's the difference here, is that I'm sure your mom's passionate about her work and managing and like making sure everything's going right. And for my mom, it was sort of just, she was interested in flavors and in exploring all these different cuisines and all these like fine dining type things.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think that there's like, I mean, in my brain in particular, like there's this binary that I think about within the food world or cooking. So like there's this notion of like exploring flavors and origins and everything through cookbooks and like following recipes or stories about recipes, right? And then there's also this very colloquial way that we understand food, like through like passing down recipes, like through word of mouth. Like there's nothing written down. Like my mom doesn't do recipes at all. Like I've never seen her like reference like a cookbook or a piece of paper or anything. So like the way I was raised, like in Western schools, like we prioritize or we celebrate like the like this notion of like follow the cookbook, like the cookbook's telling you the good recipes. So my mom's performing this type of labor that's like a lower class or more working class or more immigranty, you know, where she's just like, this is how we do it. I don't know how to tell you. I literally can't even tell you the name of this vegetable in English. So how am I supposed to know what to get at the store, right? So maybe that's also like I'm therapizing myself, but like why I try to like distance myself from it, because I didn't want to be that. And I think that in my family, like there was this understanding that like women are supposed to intuitively know how to cook. That's why you don't need cookbooks. And that seemed like a very like working class immigrant labor thing that I didn't want to practice or associate myself with. But maybe that was like you're saying that this, I had this gender role imposed upon me.
A defense mechanism. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though I knew that, like, even though I loved and respect my mom and I love and respect her work, but it wasn't something that I wanted to do for myself. And I think I wanted to have like that own agency as even as a young child. Or
I want to hear from Zahir actually. Also, so who taught you to cook? Because you're a lovely cook.
Oh, I don't know if I'm a lovely cook. You know, I guess my mom taught me. My mom taught me how to cook. But you know, it's so similar to what you're saying too, Amy. That like, my mom doesn't have these recipes written down. My family's Indian from Tanzania, and she just kind of knows. And but it's really interesting though, because when she started writing down the recipes and started like, now she emails me, like, I think she then starts realizing how complex her food is. Because my mom does these things that are just like my mom has this thing she calls her bomb sauce. And she's like, oh, just simple, just add this bomb sauce. It's like it's so many ingredients. And the one thing that was really how I know my mom likes my partner, right? You know, my partner Claire, is like when my mom emailed Claire the recipes, she gave her the full recipes as opposed to previous women I've dated. My mom gives like an abbreviated, oh, what does that woman know? I'm going to give her an abbreviated version. So, you know, it's something that, and then I love sharing my mom's recipes. And then sometimes I've been lucky to meet some chefs and like, they're like, wow, this is really complex. And I tell it to my mom. My mom says, really? But you know, for me, I definitely do see those gendered roles, like where my mom was the one doing all the cooking and the cleaning. And so that's something that, it's something I still sort of struggle with, right? Like, you know, when I was living in India, like you go to families where, you know, my friend's wife was pregnant and she's like making us like hot, you know, chapatis, and she's pregnant. And I'm like, and I really enjoy speaking to his wife. I'm like, don't worry about it. I used to bring chapatis or naan. That way his wife does, and she still would do that. And it's like, so that I really sort of wrestle with that, and I don't really know what to say or what to do. You know, it's kind of a weird thing. And like in my relationship, like my partner cooks, so she's a better cook than me. I do all the cleaning, but it's kind of this weird thing. So I still wrestle with it a lot. And I have a lot of friends who are also like that too. They have this aversion to cooking, because I think that's one thing that's been so amazing about this process, is seeing how people relate to food in different ways. And you know, I was really struck by the way that your descriptions as well too, because you have such a beautiful way of describing like your mom's hands and the rice and stuff like that. And so I'm wondering, I know you're a writer and you're about to start this, you know, great MFA program. Like, have you always had those writerly impulses, the way you describe things in such like beautiful ways?
I guess.
like for example, like, okay, what I want to, so for example, like, so I, when I was growing up, like, my mom was like, oh, you know, boys, what do boys know about cooking? So I was kind of off on the side. And so I got to really, like, I got to, like, observe my mom. And I think, like, I just learned a lot from just watching her. Maybe not about cooking, but just looking at the colors and the textures and her hands. And, like, I always, like, one thing I really miss is, like, the sound of my mom's bangles, like, on the, you know, kitchen counters and stuff like that. And so I picked up these sounds. And I think now that I'm writing, I think a lot about those things. Like, for you, since, like, how did that experience for you, like, shape you, like, as a writer?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think that, and I don't know if this is tied to being, like, children of immigrants, but and maybe like children of immigrants that are like not following this sort of narrow path that our parents want us to go through, because there are prescribed paths that, like, you, if you were to be a good child of immigrants, you would, like, you know, become a doctor or become a lawyer or whatever, or get an MBA, make $1 billion. But I think that, like, for those of us who at a young age knew that, like, we're probably not going to do that. Like, it's not that we become ostracized, but we kind of, like, pull ourselves away a little, because then we become, I know that for me, and it sounds like from you too, Zahir, that you become more like an observer of, like, where you are, because you're trying to be like, I'm going to observe how my family is, how my family like reacts or sits in this, like, larger white world. So then you really become an observer, because you're watching, like, how people behave, so that you can see where you fit in or, like, how you don't want to fit in. And I think that could be why, like, I have vivid like visual memories, because I watched a lot. Even though, like, I also inserted myself and was, like, talking a lot, because I'm also really talky. But I think that there was also a part of me that was, like, I'm trying to understand, like, what's... Even as a child, I'm trying to understand, like, what's going on. Like, wait, my family looks like this, but every family on TV does not look like me. Like, without question, there are no families on TV that look like me. So, like, just trying to figure out, like, where we were. And then also, you know, children pick up things. I was also recognizing that my parents didn't know what was going on to an extent, right? They knew enough to, like, raise us, but, like, they were also navigating a whole new world. So I wonder if that's something that, like, influences us as writers, like, all of us. Like, we have to take in all these different senses, because nothing is given to us. Like, we have to, as really young people, like, understand more than we need to. You know, I don't know if you all experience this, but, like, little things, like having to call the utility companies for your parents because they don't speak English good enough, right? Like, I remember being 6 and calling the phone company and saying, there's, like, this, like, our phone bill is wrong. You know what I mean? So, like, when you're, like, that young and you're having to do that, you're becoming way more aware of, like, real life adult shit than you need to. And I think that, like, rewires your brain to an extent. It's like you're worried about money as, like, an elementary school student. I feel like I had a great childhood for what I had, but there are moments where I feel like, wow, like, this is not like a very normal, like, childhood story for growing up in America. So I wonder if that does influence us to be more observant and to take in things more, because they're so markedly different than what we saw on television or what we saw our classmates do. If, like, we went to a school with lots of students that didn't look like us. I felt like it made me more observant.
Was that same experience with you, Soleil? Did it make you more observant?
Well, okay. So I was thinking while you were talking, right? And I think language is huge for us, right? There's a point at which, because Vietnamese was my first language. I was raised by my grandparents for a while. And when I started to learn English, mainly from Looney Tunes, like, I started to lose it. And I had this distinct memory of being picked up from first grade when I had really started to lose my Vietnamese. And I wanted to tell my grandfather all about my day, but I couldn't. Because I realized, I had remembered this like a lightning strike. I was like, he's not going to understand what I say. And so, yeah, I don't know, just it makes you more observant of, like, words and just, like, meaning and all of the ocean that separates us if we don't use the right words or don't know how to use the right words.
Do you sometimes feel like you're between languages? So, like, I grew up speaking English. It's my first language, and I speak a bit of some South Asian languages. But I, at the same time, I also feel like I'm often said, you know, told, like, oh, your English is so good, especially in super white Portland. But also in the sense of, like, I also feel like the way my parents communicate is there are gaps in when I speak with them, because I've gotten more, conversant and comfortable with certain my own voice. But I also wonder if in doing that, I find myself more distant to them. You know, especially as I start writing now, like I found my writing voice, I feel like, or I'm still finding it. But that's sort of made it harder to communicate with my parents. And it's interesting because I would think that as I get older, it'd be easier. I guess I'm more comfortable now with the gaps in our communication. How about you? What's your experience been like in terms of communicating with your parents?
It feels heartbreaking, to be completely frank, because there's so many complex things that as an adult you want to be able to share with your parents or to communicate with them, but I just don't have the words. So I end up really flatly distilling things to the simplest forms, you know? Like, I'm an editor at a feminist media organization. Like you have no idea how difficult that is to explain to my parents, you know, to first explain what an editor is, and then explain what like a feminist is or what feminism is, and then to explain what my job is on a day-to-day basis. Like, I could say that to a vast majority of English speakers, theoretically, in America, and they would understand what my job is or where I'm working. But it's so hard just to communicate what my day-to-day, how I get paid, job is to my own parents. And then I think that there's another part about being a writer in a language that your parents don't speak, mm-hmm. is that, you're crafting these stories that are a part of you, that you want to share with other people, but your own parents are unable to read them. That fucks me up so bad. Cause I know I've written about my own parents, and to think that they can't even read this piece of work that I've poured so much of myself in, that I created. I think that gulf is I think for storytellers who aren't writing in their native language or their parents' language, that's I think that's one of the most heartbreaking parts, is you've created this piece of art that you can't share on a very base level with your parents. And and you know that they came here so that theoretically you could do that. This isn't what my parents wanted for me. My parents wanted for me to really just get an office admin job and just chill out and get life and health insurance for the rest of my life and not have to struggle and worry. But I decided no, I would rather tell stories and not get paid very much. So I think it's just one of those really heartbreaking things that I know you came here so that I could pursue something like this, but now you can't even read what I'm writing. I think that's one of the hardest parts about being a writer as a child of immigrants, where your parents cannot or are unable to read what you're writing.
Yeah, it's such a cruel irony, isn't it?
I often hear from my parents that when they read my stuff, they can't really recognize me. You know, my mom always says, "Oh, you're so funny at the dinner tables here, but why aren't you funny in your articles?" And I like to believe that my writing is who I am as a person. But my mom always says, "I've known you 9 months longer than anyone else in this world," you know, and yet so she reads my stuff and can't really recognize me. And I feel like the more I've started writing, the more we've grown distant from each other. And that really makes me sad. I mean, I talk to my mom all the time, practically every day. But the writing has made me more distant. And that's a really weird thing, because I spend so much time writing and finding my voice, and my parents to be like, "Who is this? Mm-hmm. Where did that person go that we raised?" And that's a weird thing, especially when your writing gets celebrated by others. As a writer, is that something? Is that a moment you still want, your mom or dad to say, "Amy, look, I read this piece, this short story, bam, it's awesome, it's there." Do you still want that? Do you look for that?
I think that like I've described to you, my history with my family is that I haven't followed this path that they've wanted me to go towards. So there's this part of me that I think in my late teens to now, obviously it continues to be this way, but I'm unable to be my full self around them. I can't be who I truly am, you know? And I think that being a writer is part of that. When I'm around them, I can tell that I'm censoring myself. I'm not saying what I really want to say, because I just want them to be happy that they're seeing me when I'm visiting. I don't know if it's possible for me to be my full self with my folks, even though I desperately want to be, because being my full self to my parents might be somebody who they don't approve of completely. and like the writing might be part of it. Cause like a lot of my stories like are like some scandalous shit. There's a lot of like fucking in them, you know, there's a, unapologetic, you know, like random stuff that like, I don't think my parents want me to be talking about or writing about. So do I want them to read that? I don't know. And like, do I want them to be like, I get you after reading this story about sex work, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So it's a hard thing, I think, as a writer to try to figure out, like, especially when I think like we come from cultures that are so family centered.
How about for you, Soleil? Like, with your writing with your mom or your sister? Like,
man. So I guess I've gotten. I mean, I've had a bit of a like mini career as a writer, right? And every time, like, no matter what anyone says or like how they praise me or like engage with the work, like it all feels really hollow, you know? Because like it always feels like I am being like I'm stepping like further and further away from my family, who, you know, they're very supportive, but they just don't read my work. They just don't know. Like, they're not in that world. They're not in the literary world. They don't know what the literary world is. So it just doesn't seem like my place. And like, I think there's always a part of me that wishes like I could just somehow reconcile the two, but I don't know how.
Isn't it more tough because we're also writing about our families?
Yes.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and I write nonfiction, you know, I know you write fiction and nonfiction took for your magazine work, but I guess my parents, sometimes they read my stuff and they think, were you not happy as a child? You know? And I was. I had an amazing childhood, you know. Like, of course, you know, I experienced a lot of, like, racism and stuff like that. But I was really happy as a child. And they read my stuff and they think, like, and now they're getting older. And I think, you know, God forbid if something were to happen to them, I don't want them to feel like, so we failed him, you know. And that's a tough thing. And I think also just being a writer, I feel like a failure. I mean, so much of writing is about failing, you know, failing with drafts, failing with my bank balance, failing with so many things. Do you know what I mean? Failing with rejections. We know failing is just part of writing, right? But it's like feeling that failure from your parents, because it's like, you know, you went to a good college. You could have maximized your potential by, you know, I used to work in Congress. And it's like, why couldn't you have just stayed doing that? And it's like, why are you writing now?
You know, the question I dread the most from my family is, why are you so ungrateful?
Yeah. When I met you, Amy, it was like, I feel like here, more so than any other city I've lived in America, when I meet a person of color who's a writer who's so dynamic like you, like, I remember when I met you, I told my partner, like, I'm going to fight to be friends with her. I'm going to fight. I'm going to make sure. And I feel like, you know, so I don't really know where this is going, this question. I guess,
you just love Amy.
Yeah,
okay.
I do. This is going to be like a 10-part interview. You're not leaving for Mississippi. You've really created such amazing spaces here for us. I mean, really. I mean, you've been here for 11 years. Like, it's incredible. Like, we're all so indebted to you. There's no question at the end of this. I'm just gushing.
This is like a speech at a wedding. I can't handle this right now.
Okay, it's too much. Anyways.
Okay. Anyway, Amy, we love you. And thank you for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me on your show. Yeah. I love the show.
Thank you for listening to Racist Sandwich. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. If you have any feedback for us, as always, we'd love to hear what you think of the show. So you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Race and Food, or email us at racistsandwichpodcast@gmail.com.
Our show is recorded at KBOO Community Radio in Southeast Portland and produced by Alan Montesilio.
Jen Tam designed our logo, and our music comes from Af the Naysayer and Blue Dot Sessions.
We're having our second meetup at Abbey Creek Winery in North Plains, Oregon. That's about a 30-minute drive from downtown Portland, so we will be carpooling. That's on the 21st of August at 1 p.m. Everyone is welcome, so we hope to see you there. It'll be great wine tasting, and there'll be a potluck. So bring your friends, bring some food, and that's the 21st.
Yeah, and of course, Abbey Creek is the winery of Bertoni Faustin, who is Oregon's first black winemaker and our first guest.
In 2 weeks, we'll be bringing you an episode about the food economy in Portland with the Portland Kitchen and some professors from Portland State University. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you in 2 weeks.